Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. The number of American troops who have been killed in Afghanistan has almost reached 2,000, and recent attacks on NATO troops by Afghani soldiers and police officers have raised some serious questions about NATO's training program for Afghan forces. U.S. and coalition forces, as you know, are slated to leave by the end of 2014. This is what President Obama said on Monday of this week regarding these increasing green-on-blue attacks.
Part of what's taking place is we are transitioning to Afghan security. And for us to train them effectively, we are in much closer contact. Our troops are in much closer contact with Afghan troops on an ongoing basis. Part of what we've got to do is to make sure that this model works, but it doesn't make our guys more vulnerable.
There have been a number of these attacks, 32 confirmed insider attacks so far this year, 40 coalition forces killed in such incidents in 2012, including 26 Americans. And the overriding question is, what in the world is the motive for these attacks? Later this hour, we'll be talking about the recent increase in active duty military suicides, which is another troubling trend. And our guest this hour is Mark Thompson. He is Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for Time. He also moderates Time's Battlefield blog, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Mark. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Mark Thompson, thank you very much for joining us. Good morning to you.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Please outline, to begin the program, these green-on-blue attacks. What does it refer to, and why has there been an increase in the number of them?
Well, it's sort of funny. Both green-on-blue and Army suicides have a complex cause, and there's no single size. There's no one solution can solve it. And in the case of the green-on-blue attacks, for the first 5 to 6 years of the Afghan war, post-October 7th, 2001, when the U.S. military invaded, they were down in the white noise, very down in the weeds, very few of them, actually. But as we came close to, coming on a decade, 11 years now there, since 2007, they've spiked quite a lot. And, in fact, of all of the green-on-blue attacks that have occurred over the last 5 years, 40% of them have occurred so far in the first 7 months of 2012, and 35% occurred in all of 2011. So they really are on the rise. Now, you talk to people in Afghanistan, U.S. military, and you talk to U.S. military people here in Washington, and number one, they don't have a precise breakdown of why these attacks are happening, but the consensus is that roughly half of them are indeed either Taliban or Taliban-influenced individuals who are killing American and allied soldiers out of a religious fervor. The other half is more likely to be personal grievances, anger, feeling of being slighted. I mean, the Afghan people are much different than the folks that are training them, and lots of resentments can build up, and the sense of pride in Afghanistan is very strong, and if you even inadvertently say or do something that offends their honor, this can result.
Mm-hmm. And green on blue refers to Afghan wearing green, NATO wearing blue?
Well, no, it's not literally true. I mean, whenever the U.S. military engages in any sort of a military exercise, they are always the blue force. And generally, they're going against a red force. And if they are paired with an ally, oftentimes the ally is the green force. So you want, or you believe, or you expect you will have blue-on-red violence. You do not expect blue-on-green violence.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the screening process for somebody to become a member of the Afghan forces. There must be some problem with that, allowing people in who are killers.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, a couple of things on that score. Number one, There is an eight-step process that the Afghans and their allies undertake before someone comes into the Afghan military. It involves everything from two letters from village elders vetting this individual, along with a variety of criminal and drug tests and all sorts of scrutiny. But there's two problems with that. Number one, it isn't always done. Even for the folks coming in, Afghanistan remains a relatively primitive society. And, you know, all the check marks that are supposed to be checked often don't get checked. And then number two, as we saw in the horrible case of August 10th, where a so-called T-boy, unpaid volunteer to a local police chief in Helmand Province, was living on a base with the police chief, and the base was shared with American soldiers. And this fellow was only 15, and one day he was able to steal a Kalashnikov rifle, an AK-47, with a full magazine of live ammo, and simply walked into a makeshift gymnasium that the Marines had set up and murdered three and grievously wounded a fourth. This was a fellow who had never been vetted in any way. And, you know, I think it's a fair question for Americans to ask, how could the Marines have let this happen? And, you know, we've asked it on our blog, these are the things that happen in wartime. But after having been there for 11 years, you think that these sort of problems would not exist, especially when the potential for trouble of this nature seems so high.
Is this story true that the police officer was involved in sexual misconduct with his 15-year-old?
Well, that certainly is the story coming out of Afghanistan. He denies it, but, that is a common tradition among the Pashtun in southern Afghanistan, and it certainly would answer a lot of questions, but at this point in time, there's been no definite finding on that.
And what about the Taliban infiltration of these police forces? How is that happening? How do they do that?
Well, it's important to understand the concept of jihad among certain elements of the Muslim religion. In many cases, it is like a light switch. You come into the Afghan military, you can be a perfectly law-abiding, wonderful soldier. But then if you get that whatever it is, that vision, that insight that says you must kill the infidels, it's like a light switch that goes on. So you can be perfectly vetted and be legitimate and, you know, pass muster on every score, but there is some small slice of Muslims, especially among the Pashtun, that will happen to them. And, you know, it can be while you're peeling potatoes. All of a sudden you say, no, this cannot be tolerated. We cannot have these infidels in our country, and boom, you pick up a gun and you start shooting. So that's partly why screening isn't the only solution here, and is partly why the U.S. and its allies are now relying on these guardian angel concepts, in which case you've got one allied or two allied soldiers who, in a training or mentoring exercise with Afghan troops, basically are keeping their eyes on our Afghan allies, guns at the ready, and are ready to, you know, put down any sort of violence that the Afghan allies might try to perpetrate. In the same way, you know, recently Marine General John Allen, the ISAF, International Security Assistance Force commander in Afghanistan, ordered everybody under his command to carry their guns loaded at all times, even inside headquarters and on posts, and that really, you know, affects the morale of troops. When you can't trust your allies to the degree that you can't relax when you come inside the wire where you're supposed to be able to have some respite from what's going on outside the wire, is pretty depressing, according to soldiers I've spoken with.
I would imagine you have to have trust or it all breaks down.
Yeah, it certainly does, and that is a real... I mean, let's face facts. These attacks are militarily insignificant. As you noted at the top, perhaps close to 2,000 U.S. troops have died in Afghanistan since October 7th of 2001. That's a you can't minimize the loss of any life, but that's less than 200 lives a year, and this is a major war. That's a pretty small number. Then when you look at that number of 2,000, Secretary Panetta the other day, the Secretary of Defense, noted, we've got, I don't know what period of time he was talking about, but he said we have 350,000 Afghans now in their military, and we've had 31 of these types of attacks. Well, if you do the math, that works out to 0.009%, you know, well far lower than 1% of these folks are bad apples. But they cast a very long and a very dark shadow over the entire enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what you make of this U.S. military behavioral scientist who interviewed more than 600 Afghan soldiers and police and found they had overwhelmingly negative perceptions of Western soldiers because of alleged indiscriminate shootings, killing civilians, the public searching of Afghan soldiers outside NATO bases, U.S. soldiers urinating in public or cursing at their Afghan counterparts. Is that a significant finding?
Sure. I mean, you know, war never occurs in a vacuum, and neither does a military occupation. It all happens in the environment that's been created, whether it be created by the Taliban leading up to September 11th, 2001, or whether it be created by the continuing occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and allied forces. Plainly, anyone who's ever lived in an occupied country and been among those occupied finds it very distasteful, doesn't like it, and that automatically sort of, you know, makes the occupying force on the defensive. And plainly, over time, that can only grow, even despite all the good wishes and even despite the tens of billions of dollars that U.S. taxpayers have shoveled into Afghanistan to try to make it a better country. The fact is that people resent occupiers, and I think that sort of sets the stage for some of these sort of incidents we're discussing.
So how does NATO and the U.S. deal with that?
Well, it doesn't. You know, it is sort of, as I said, it's part of the environment. It's like, you know, Mao used to talk about the guerrillas are fishes and they swim in the water of public support. In the same way, you get outside of Kabul and there aren't many folks there who are resolutely happy to see the Americans and their allies there every day with their guns. There's no way really to do away with that. That is a function of occupation, that is a function of a military. The only way to do away with it is to get out.
And when you look at the infiltration by the Taliban, are the Afghan forces aware of that infiltration? And is it upsetting to them?
You mean when it happens?
Yes.
Well, plainly, President Hamid Karzai told Secretary Panetta over the weekend that it is very alarming to him, because it's important to point out, as Panetta has several times, really, green on blue is somewhat of a misnomer, because a lot of it's green on green. Marty Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recently spoke of an American who was coming under attack by an Afghan, and two Afghan soldiers were killed along with the American when this Afghan turned on the American. The two Afghans were killed as they came to the American's rescue. So that certainly isn't really green on blue. It's green on blue on green on blue. So, you know, the Pentagon prefers the phrase insider attacks simply because many times these attacks result in Afghan as well as U.S. and coalition deaths.
We are going to welcome phone calls for our guests, and we ask what you would like to know about military strategy as it relates to Afghanistan and the NATO pullout slated for 2014. We have to ask, we are on pace to leave at the end of 2014, whether or not the Afghan forces are trained and ready to secure the country. That's fairly significant. Our guest is Mark Thompson, Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for Time, and he also moderates Time's Battleland blog. We're inviting you to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lines are open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yes, is there a question there?
What do you think about that?
Well, I think he's right. I'm not convinced we've killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. It doesn't make any difference, as we discussed earlier. Plainly, a military occupation is an unnatural state of governance, and the people are going to rebel. It would be no different if America were taken over.
Are we still on pace to leave this country at the end of 2014, even if Afghan forces aren't up to the task of securing the country?
Sure. I mean, that's a political decision. If it were a military decision, there never would have been that deadline. It isn't a military decision. There is civilian control of the military. On Battleland this morning, I have a Marine writing about why is now the time to pull out of Afghanistan and not wait for all combat forces to come out by the end of 2014. The country is exhausted. The country feels it has given enough. We have been there now for 11 years. There is great doubt inside the national security establishment of the United States that the progress that has been made over that span of time can be maintained after we pull out, whether that pullout is today, 2015, or 2020.
Mm. And what do they cite as progress?
Well, they cite as progress a number of Afghan girls going to school, which is way up. The economy is way up, but that's mostly because of all the money we're pumping in. But things like health care. There are health clinics now sprinkled over many areas of Afghanistan that never had them before, and that's to the people's benefit. So are various water and irrigation projects that are bringing clean water and more sustainable forms of agriculture to places in Afghanistan that hadn't had it in the past, all of which, of course, is designed to wean the folks, especially in southern Afghanistan, out of the opium business.
Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. You answered a little bit of my question. I wanted to know a little bit about what kind of progress is being made in the nation-building end of this. But that relates, I think, to a larger issue, which is, I mean, do we have like a real serious big time goal here? I mean, obviously we've set an end date, but you know, we set an end date in Iraq, but we still got troops in Iraq, right? And I'm thinking, is this going to be this kind of a thing where we will be looking, you know, decades down the line and still having some kind of a behind the scenes presence a la Korea? Or is this a kind of thing where we're thinking, okay, we just got to cut our losses, kind of ease our way back out of here and cross our fingers and hope for the best?
Well, those are good questions, Scott. A couple of things. Number one, yes, we still do have a relatively small presence in Iraq. But it's important to realize that in 2006, many here in Washington thought the Iraq war was lost. Yet it ended up really not being lost. We came back, we did the surge, and things there are creaky, and there's a lot of internal violence, but it's not certainly the way it was in 2006, 2007, and Saddam Hussein is no longer running that country. Our goal in Afghanistan, well, originally, you know, it was sort of grandiose. It has been scaled back considerably now. It's simply this, that Afghanistan cannot be allowed to become a place where bad guys can launch attacks against America, which is what happened on 9/11. Now, you can make the argument that we are doing that same mission in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and various other ungoverned or ungovernable parts of the world, largely from the air, largely with unmanned drones equipped with Hellfire missiles, and a handful of special forces. So some people will say, well, why can't we do that with Afghanistan? And that, I think, is a fair question and one that is open to debate. Plainly, our deadline for pulling all of our combat troops, not all of our troops, but all of our combat troops out of Iraq by New Year's Eve of 2014 is going to happen. I think the politics will demand it. But come on, let's face facts here. Number one, when we pulled out of Iraq, one night we simply called a bunch of combat divisions. We made them train and advise divisions. So they ceased to be combat troops, and they became trainers. So they were okay. And that's going to happen in Afghanistan. It's already been made clear. Karzai has already asked. The Obama administration has already agreed that a substantial number of troops, perhaps 5, 7, 8,000, will stay in Afghanistan into 2015 and perhaps well beyond. So you're right. It's not going to be like Korea, where we've got 25,000 troops that have been there for 60 years, but it is going to be a sustained presence for some period of time after the mission, like the mission in Iraq, is officially declared over.
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Sure, Scott. Go ahead.
Thanks. Obviously, you more than probably a lot of people know that there's a substantial difference going in between the infrastructure, the education level, the sophistication, blah, 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 of Iraq compared to Afghanistan, which is, from my understanding, never been a place that was particularly well-governed, well-run, very well, certainly well-educated. How's your optimism level?
Well, I think that's an apt point, but here's the key thing. Iraq was a secular government that was centralized. So things could happen when Baghdad said for things to happen. Afghanistan was well-run and well-governed until about 40 years ago. It was a tribal culture. It was a patchwork of little principalities run basically by warlords, but each one tended to his own flock, tended to his own valley, and things went, if not swimmingly, at least they went okay. After the Soviets invaded, and ever since 1979, things have gone haywire. And you talk to a lot of people here in Washington about the U.S. desire to make a centralized Afghan government work. And some people think that's just a leap too far, that given 2,000 years of history, given its a warlord-like nature, the notion of making President Karzai president of Afghanistan instead of what he really is, which is the mayor of Kabul, is sort of an impossible-to-achieve mission. We're going to have to wait and see on that, but already you see militias and local police forces being set up by the coalition to take over when they pull out, and it's beginning to look like the warlords are going to gain the sway that they had lost in the last 10 years.
Thank you so much, Scott, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Mark Thompson is our guest on the Ideas Network this hour, Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for Time. We're looking at a couple serious issues. We have yet to talk about an increase in active duty military suicides, which is alarming, and we're now looking at the attacks by Afghani soldiers killing 40 NATO troops, including 23 Americans, this year. And it's an increase. Before we go back to phone calls, Mark, let me ask you, when you talk about our mission is in the area to keep bad guys from launching attacks against the United States, would we put the Taliban in that group, and are we concerned about a resurgence of the Taliban, or are they in a different category?
Well, no, they are. The Taliban are neither black or white. The sense you get from talking to U.S. intelligence officials is that 80% of the Taliban are the $10 Taliban, which is for $10 a day, they're Taliban. If someone else pays them $15, they're not Taliban. Hmm. They're in it for, a simple living wage. There is a slice of the Taliban that basically is incorrigible, whether it's 5%, 10%, 20%, nobody really knows. So the U.S. position has been the Taliban, whichever form it takes, must renounce violence, must be prepared to keep its country from becoming a haven for terrorists. And the U.S. is plainly eager to negotiate with a representative of the Taliban who will sign up to the renunciation of violence, because there is no way, if you talk to anybody in the U.S. military, that the Taliban cannot be part of the solution. They must be part of the solution with some of their more extreme elements weeded out.
And have you been able to identify who those people we would want to negotiate with are?
No, I mean, unfortunately, it's a lot like the current Republican Party. You've got, you know, your outliers that sort of keep the bulk of the party from doing what they think is the right thing. There have been, you know, notions that this Taliban group can meet with the U.S. or that Taliban group can meet with the U.S. And then, you know, their leaders are either assassinated or Afghanistan's minister of negotiations is assassinated. There is a determined group that doesn't want any accommodation with the United States or with President Karzai. And so long as that group is willing to exert its power at the point of a gun, it's tough to see how the U.S. and the Taliban can sit down. But plainly, if they don't sit down and negotiate something before the end of 2014 and the safe havens continue to exist across the border in Pakistan, you know, all bets are off in terms of the ultimate success of this mission.
Mm-hmm. An email from Wayne in Madison who asks, how much influence has WikiLeaks had since it paints America in a bad light?
Not that much. I mean, number one, WikiLeaks primarily dealt with the Iraq war in terms of what generated attention. Plainly, the flood of information that it provided, you know, it was sort of like reading other people's mail. I mean, the diplomatic community was in a big tizzy because it basically showed that diplomats routinely shade the truth this way and that way and tell Washington one thing and tell Kabul or Baghdad or Islamabad something else. But I think that really was a bigger problem inside the U.S. government and for individual governments around the world in terms of how they were portrayed in cables back to Washington from their ambassadors and diplomatic staffs than in terms of what it has done on the ground in Afghanistan.
The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, in Afghanistan earlier this week, he had some problems with his plane, evidently, that was damaged by enemy fire on the Bagram airfield in Afghanistan. Can you talk about that incident and what he may have accomplished on his trip?
Well, he was plainly there to chat with General Allen, President Karzai, and other Afghan and U.S. military leaders on the green-on-blue attacks. That's what got all of the attention. Early Tuesday, his huge C-17, a monstrous gray four-engine plane, was sitting on the tarmac at Bagram. I've been to Bagram. You cannot see anything on Bagram from outside the base. It is huge. So every once in a while, the Taliban or other insurgents will lob mortars or rockets or crude missiles somewhere in that wide expanse north of Kabul, and sometimes they hit something. Yesterday, what happened was at least a pair of rounds, they're not sure what, landed on the runway or the tarmac close to the chairman's C-17, did not hit his C-17, but when they detonated on the ground near the C-17, they shot shrapnel into the airplane as well as into a nearby Apache helicopter, effectively grounding both. It was a lucky shot. It happens every once in a while. I mean, Bagram is routinely shelled at least a couple of times a month by the other side. And, of course, we never hear about it unless something like this happens. I mean, it's interesting to note that when Secretary Panetta was in Helmand Province in March, when he landed his airplane, an Afghan interpreter had carjacked a pickup truck and was racing it alongside the runway. When he ended up in a ditch, it exploded and he died. In the same way, when Paul Wolfowitz was the number two civilian at the Pentagon, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, way back in October of 2003, he was spending the night at the Al Rashid Hotel in downtown Baghdad when a volley of rocket fire hit the hotel, killed a U.S. Army colonel staying one floor below Secretary Wolfowitz and wounding 16 or 17 other folks. And these attacks get a lot of attention, but also, like green-on-blue attacks, are effectively militarily insignificant, but they have large political ramifications. And what's interesting is, you know, yesterday's attack on the chairman's plane was very much like a tree falling in a forest. If the chairman's plane hadn't been there, you never would have heard about it.
Right. Diane in Milwaukee, hi.
Why can't we just pack up and go? They don't want us there. They're going to work against us all the time. It's not worth it. What are we getting out of this besides dead bodies?
Well, Diane, that's a very pungent question, and it's one that's being asked a lot more these days in Washington, especially as the green-on-blue attacks continue. The key question is, and to make it as blunt as possible, if those attacks pick up, that question will be asked everywhere. They've sort of subsided, thank God. There haven't been any in a couple of days, which is how it has been. I mean, there was a spike late last year, then they went down, then they dramatically spiked over the last month, and now they may be subsiding again. But your point is well taken. The United States government has decided it is in the nation's interest to at least cleanse out as many of the terrorists, militants, insurgents, whatever you want to call them, as they can before the U.S. troops leave, and then hand off this responsibility largely to an Afghan national security force that we've spent $50 or $60 billion building over the last decade. Military people will tell you that President Obama's time frame was too short. You cannot, put a thumbtack in a calendar and basically say we're going to leave by this point in time. But all of the generals, the Joint Chiefs, everybody else signed up to it. Nobody said, sir, I can't do that, and if you're going to make me try to do that, I'm going to have to resign my commission and maybe hold a press conference. Nobody has done that. So basically the military hierarchy is behind what the president is doing. They think they can, they're not going for 100%, but they think they can get 75 or 80% of what they need to have done by the time they pull out the combat forces by the end of 2014. That is not that far away. It's, a year and a half away from now. So the end is rapidly approaching. It's not as fast as some people would like, but, plainly, it is nigh.
Well, you cover all these things. Shouldn't we have been able to accomplish the task that you just gave to us, the goal, in 11 years?
Well, that's a fair question, Kathleen. I think it's worth noting that when we went into Afghanistan, we had one goal. It was to topple the Taliban. We did that by the end of calendar 01. We could have come home then and said, hey, if they come back, we're coming back. But we did not do that. We elected perhaps 6 months in, 3 to 6 months in, to a much more expansive mission in Afghanistan than our initial one. And, historians will look back on that and say, was that the right move? Did we do the right thing? Should we have been more modest? And those are all fair questions. But once we got in there with a teaspoon mission, and then after we were in there for a while, we decided to change it to a tablespoon, is a fair observation. And plainly, the expanded mission was much tougher to do.
Mike in Columbia County, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Mike, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. Love your show. Hey, I was in Iraq for a year with the U.S. Army, and I was at four different bases, but I spent a majority of my time in my headquarters, and my brigade command was at Balad Air Base.
Right.
And we had the same situation, except we got mortared or rocketed from the first day I was there, woke me up at 4 o'clock in the morning, the last day. In fact, the young troops and everybody else referred to it as Mortaritaville.
Mm-hmm.
So that they didn't know what they were shooting at Balad either, but they just did it to harass us, and it definitely kept us off guard.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, what year were you there, Mike?
I got there in May of 2004 and left in 2005.
Okay, well, thank you for your service.
Well, you're very welcome, but It was just like doing a job, except people were shooting at us.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that a lot. It's important to realize that things have improved dramatically in Iraq since then. So, you know, for the naysayers who are saying, oh, let's pull out of Afghanistan because it's going to heck in a handbasket, it's important to note that a lot of people were saying that about Iraq. And in 2006, and the U.S. military and their allies, as well as some, you know, political changes on the ground in Iraq, pretty much turned that situation around. And so, you know, there is some hopeful thinking inside the U.S. military that vis-a-vis Afghanistan, they can pull to an inside straight again.
Thank you so much for your call, Mike. We continue our conversation. Our guest, Mark Thompson, has written about a record number of soldiers, 38 of them suspected of killing themselves in the month of July. This, according to a Pentagon report last week. Mark says it's a startling jump in the suicide epidemic that has been frustrating Army leaders for years. Why is that happening? We'll talk with Mark about that and welcome your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always go to our Facebook page. I'm glad a member of the military called. We would like to hear, well, from everybody, but particularly from members of the U.S. military, military families, what can be done to deal with the increase of suicide among active duty soldiers, and why is there an increase in this? We'll go back to our conversation. Take your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, recent comments from Representative Todd Akin from Missouri concerning what he called legitimate rape have raised criticisms from around the world. We'll be talking with a political reporter from Missouri about the future of Akin's Senate campaign, and we'll also have an anti-sexual assault advocate to discuss the social, emotional, and psychological effects of rape. That's coming up. Hour two of our show. Mark Thompson is our guest this hour, Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, also moderates Time's Battleland blog. He did the cover story on military suicides recently, and we would like to talk about that, which is, of course, an extremely disturbing topic. Mark, you talk about the fact that we have a record number here of soldiers suspected of killing themselves last month. That's kind of takes your breath away.
Well, I mean, we are, yes, it does. It's a terrible tragedy. And like the Green on Blue killings, there is no one key to open the door to fix this problem. Every suicide is unique. It's comprised of a bunch of factors. They differ from person to person, soldier to soldier. One soldier can deploy 10 times and not have a problem. Another can deploy once and become depressed and anxious, even if they experience the same sorts of combat and carnage. The military is pumping a lot of money into the problem, but plainly, according to General Peter Chiarelli, who until January was the Army's top suicide fighter and its number two officer, they're not doing enough. Plainly, research into the mind and into the levers and triggers of suicide is well beyond our understanding of things like cancer and heart attacks, he points out. And he says that mind research is basically 30 or 40 years behind research into those other diseases, and he's advocating that we really step up our study and research into the mind so we can better combat suicide.
You write that Army experts are noting a shift among suicide victims, the first time since 2001 when we're seeing non-commissioned officer deaths outnumbering junior enlisted deaths.
Yeah, I mean, it's important, and folks who may not be fluent with the military may not know what that means, but in a nutshell, if you're an NCO, a non-commissioned officer, you're a sergeant generally of some type, it means you are most likely trying to make the military your career, get your 20 years in, get your pension. It also means you're likely to be married. If you're a younger enlisted person, you're probably not married, and you may only want to stay in for 4 or 5 years. So you don't have as much at stake in the Army. But you take that older group, you know, they've been off to war, come home for 12 months, off to war, come home for 12 months, off to war. They've never had a chance since 9/11, really, to decompress and to get reintegrated again with their family. And that can be a difficult process. I mean, the spouses and the kids, if dad or mom is constantly on the deployment treadmill, there's never a sense of relaxation when he or she comes home. But when he or she comes home now, for maybe 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, all of a sudden it's time to resume living as a more normal family. And many times tensions can escalate there over all sorts of things, from an independent spouse back home to financial issues to, hey, you know, the Army is going to be shrinking, and so maybe the career I thought I was going to have for 20 years is fading away before my very eyes. So all of these things, especially Army mental health experts are theorizing, are causing a spike in suicide among, you know, older soldiers as opposed to their younger comrades.
Let's go to Jack in Eagle River. Hi, Jack.
Yes, good morning. Sometime late last year, I read an article in Time, which you may have been associated with, about suicide among Army or military recruiters.
Right. I wrote that article.
You did?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, then I remember you said something about they were under pressure. They have quotas. They, you know, under undue pressure to meet those quotas, and that certainly played a part in it. And I just wondered, I wondered about that, and here you have written it, so I better stop wondering.
Well, yeah, thank you, Jack. Okay. I mean, the recruiting story, it was a couple of years ago, I believe, was basically set in Texas. It's where Army recruiters were either heroes or zeros, depending on if they made their quotas. And remember, before the economy went south in 2008, the economy was humming along, and it was difficult to induce young men and women to enlist. So there was a lot of pressure. And the Army, like the tides, has recruiting scandals, you know, that come and go. They ebb and they flow, depending in large part on just how difficult it is to entice young men and women in. The Army took some steps in the wake of that spate of suicides down in Texas, took some power away from local commanders so they wouldn't have as much authority to compel their folks to work 6.5 days a week. And from what we know, that problem seems to have abated, perhaps in large part because the economy has gotten so tough for this particular cohort that the Army has no shortage of recruits these days.
Tell me about the mental health services that you can avail yourselves of if you're in the military, and whether or not it might be detrimental to a soldier's career to ask for mental health services.
Well, number one, they insist that it's not detrimental, that there is no stigma officially, and officially that's true. Unofficially, there remains a lot of stigma, especially down at your small unit level. You know, the soldiers talk about big Army, and that's the chief of staff and all of the 3- and 4-star generals who are generally far away from you if you're at the tip of the spear. And what they say and what happens in your own unit with your own sergeants and captains is a much different thing. I don't know if it's right to say this, but our recent cover story showed that one soldier had sought help 6 times in 3 days from the Army and was either turned away, told to wait, or we can't see you now. That gets to what General Chiarelli spoke about, that we don't have the resources deployed in this fight to do the job adequately. Secondly, you know, there are so many avenues of access that you can at least try. You may put your handle on the doorknob and turn it and find that it's locked, but they have a lot of things out there, and some people say they have too many. You know, there should be perhaps a more central funnel through which everybody could go and be triaged in accord with the immediate demands. What's important, I think, for anyone out there who's listening to this who may be troubled, is there is an important toll-free line that everybody should be aware of. It's 1-800-273-8255. 8225. You can call it and press 1 if you're a veteran or in a military family and really get good help right away. There's no reason to take your own life.
Stephen in Oshkosh. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, I was in the military a couple years ago, and I was wondering if he had any statistics on, because when I was in there, we had a lot of briefings about how a lot of the suicides are actually among a lot of people who hadn't actually deployed yet. And I was wondering if maybe they had any correlation with the relaxed standards that the military had in 05, 06, and 07 in regards to the recruits, because they were very low on them.
I think that's a good point. Thank you for your service, Steve. Number one, yes, perhaps about a third of the active duty suicides are among folks who have not deployed, which, of course, means two-thirds of them are among people who have deployed. And if you just look at that rough breakdown, you can see perhaps that, gee whiz, if we hadn't deployed these soldiers so many times, so often, you know, the military suicide rate would be much more in keeping with its historical trends, and not as it is now in the Army, 50% higher than in its age-adjusted civilian cohort. In terms of the waivers, yes, several folks with whom I have spoken talk about the moral, criminal waivers that were issued, as we were just speaking about recruiting, when the economy was humming and the Army was desperate for recruits. So, yes, I think that did play a role. I think that has contributed in some small way, but measurable way, to the issue of suicides, both among those who have deployed and those who have not.
And thank you, Stephen, for the call. Diane in Madison is next. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. I am wondering about the anti-malarial drug Larium that soldiers are issued. They take it once a week, and because they take it once a week, my understanding is the dosage is so much higher than when they would take something daily, and that this drug has been associated with psychotic behavior, suicidal behavior, and violence on the part of some individuals who have taken it. And I would like to have you talk about this, please.
Well, Larium is a drug that has been used by the military. I'm not sure it's being used as regularly today as it was in the past, and it does have these psychotic side effects that you discuss. In the same way, soldiers today are using anti-anxiety prescription medications as well as antidepressives at all-time highs. And this has been a concern among many in and outside of the military, because plainly, you can't control either the access to or proper distribution of potent, powerful medications when you're, you know, in a war zone. It's very difficult to do. This, too, was something that was exacerbated by the repeated deployments. Soldiers, each time they'd go back, there was a greater and greater share of them relying on antidepressants and anti-anxiety and sleeping aid medications. The Larium, yes, there was questions that I don't think have yet been resolved about Robert Bales, who was the sergeant who allegedly killed 17 Afghans earlier this year, whether or not he was on the drug. I think that's a good avenue for inquiry, and I believe it is continuing to be looked at by various mental health experts, both in and outside of the military.
So there are medications that are okay to be on while you're in active duty military, and some that would be restricted or not?
Yes, yes. I mean, plainly, I mean, there's actually quite a scholarly list of, if you are on these drugs, you can go off to war, but if you're on these, you can't. And basically, a lot of the SSRIs, you know, everything from Prozac to stuff of that nature is okay. And it's just like the green on blue or the suicide issue, Kathleen. Different drugs affect different people in different ways. And if the drug is perfectly okay for 99% of soldiers who take it, well, we've sent, you know, 2.5 million young men and women off to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if you're only dealing with 1% of the 10% that have been on these sorts of drugs, you're still talking a pretty significant number.
Mm-hmm. Mark, thank you for paying such close attention to all of these important issues.
Well, our pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Mark Thompson, Washington Bureau, Deputy Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, and he also moderates Time's Battleland blog, which you can find at nation.time.com. We'll put that on our Facebook page, too, so you'll be able to access that. He follows all of these issues, and there are many of them these days, very, very closely. Tomorrow at this time, a former senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees for the last 16 years, Mike Lofgren, will be joining us to talk about his new book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. That's tomorrow during this time period. Thanks for all of your calls and being involved in this conversation, and we thank Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who are the producers of this program. Coming up the next hour of our program, stay with us. We'll be talking about Todd Akin, and we will be looking at rape. We'll have several guests with us. Please stay tuned. This is the Ideas Network.